Hey folks, just a quick heads up that today we're discussing some serious topics, including medical procedures and details of medical treatment. That said, you don't want to miss this interview with Denise, so we encourage you to keep on listening. Hello and welcome. I'm Caroline.
And I'm Helen.
And we love to sew. This is a podcast for makers where we talk about sewing a handmade wardrobe and bring you interviews with inspiring creatives and small business owners in our community.
Today we are talking with Denise Archer about her battle with cancer and how sewing played a part in her treatment. Denise shares her journey from diagnosis to post-cancer and how she used sewing to find strength and share her survival with others. She also offers her perspective on body image woes and tells us about an amazing organization she founded, the People's Sewing Army.
And if you're wondering where her Instagram handle comes from, we get the story at the end.
So you gotta stick around. Hello, Denise. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, we're so excited to talk with you today. Can you please introduce yourself to our listeners?
Sure. My name is Denise Archer. I'm an at-home mom. I'm a publisher of a zine called Fried Eagle. I'm the founder of the People's Sewing Army. I'm on a city council advisory committee for the restoration and preservation of a historic bridge and view corridor. I'm a volunteer instructor at CHAP, which is Children's Healing Art Project.
Awesome. And where are you from, Denise?
Portlandia.
Portlandia.
Portland, Oregon. The beer guzzling, wine sipping, food eating, tree hugging, animal loving, hemp wearing capital of the U.S.
One of my favorite places. I love Portland. So one of the things we always ask our guests on the show is how and when they learned to sew. So can you tell us a little bit about your sewing journey?
Yeah, sure. So when I was about 5 years old is when I first noticed that my mom would sew our dance costumes because we both danced, and she would sew the group's dance costumes. And, you know, kids either learn by practicing, by doing or observing. And I was an observer. So I would watch my mom and practice with my eyes, essentially just watching her cut and sew. And I finally felt ready when I was 15 to do something on my mom's old Singer treadle machine. And I stopped wanting to wear the same clothes as my friends is what the incentive was. And I didn't want her to help me do it. I just wanted to do it myself. So, and well, I guess, you know what? I have a few things. I was just curious before we get deep into this interview. I kind of wanted to set a few expectations just for myself too. And one is that I have a tendency to meander. So please rein me in if I'm doing that. And I don't do so well speaking. My writing's very controlled. It's a control issue. You know, you write, you can just set it aside, you can edit. And since we're going to discuss cancer, inevitably we're going to discuss body and body function. And some of this might feel uncomfortable or embarrassing. I've decided that I'm going to come to you, both of you and everybody else, with just an open and honest heart. So I won't gloss over things. I'll be very direct and honest. I feel that this is a time for learning and sharing. And please, both of you, just ask your questions. There's no eggshells here. Don't walk on eggshells. Don't pussyfoot around. If you have something, you can just ask it directly. I don't get offended. I can only speak about myself, as uncomfortable as that makes me. All these me, 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 I. But, you know, I can also speak on behalf of those who've given me approval for that. And if I say you, it's just me being uncomfortable speaking about me. And it means the royal you. It means me. It still means me. So.
Well, we really appreciate that, Denise. And I'm sure our listeners will also appreciate hearing that you're coming at this from a place of total honesty and that, you know, we're going to be open today. And we are really looking forward to having this conversation with you. And we'll take that to heart. We'll try not to walk on eggshells. I know Helen and I were a little bit nervous about talking about this because we've never really broached the topic of cancer on the show before and cancer in relation to sewing. So we really appreciate your openness to come on and chat with us. And I think it's going to be a great conversation.
All right, let's get going.
So after learning to sew and starting to sew your own clothes as a teenager, where did your sewing journey take you next?
When I was 16 and got access to a car, I would actually drive to this old warehouse, this fabric store called Milland. At the time, it was a super old warehouse, bad lighting. And I would just look at fabric, and I discovered Issey Miyake and the Vogue individualist patterns then. And even though I was social, there were times where I would choose fabric over friends and just go to Milan to look at fabric. Then when I lived in Japan for a little bit, I discovered the real cost of Issey Miyake. And I realized there was no way I was going to ever be able to buy that. I was going to have to sew that. And in college, I started patching my jeans. It was actually a pair of Levi's that I ended up getting in Tokyo in this vintage store in Tokyo. And they were getting kind of ratty and worn down. And this was the 90s. So it was all about Kurt Cobain and Courtney Love and grunge movement. And so patching jeans was just easy to do. And the students started to recognize me by my jeans. And so my friends would ask me to patch their jeans. So I patched a lot of jeans during college. Even when I lived in France, I was patching people's jeans there too. And I would have to borrow, I had to borrow my neighbor's, from my French neighbor's sewing machine. Eventually, I also made and sold hats at Grateful Dead concerts and the Pride Parade to pay for my flight to France. Not that I made that much money selling hats. My mom was a really great antique collector. She would just go to the thrift stores and find these amazing stuff. So then I would just list it in the newspapers, you know, antiques for sale or whatever. And then all these antique dealers would come. I'd open the garage and just sell them stuff. And that's how I paid for my tickets to go to France. But yeah, I made this awesome striped jumpsuit. This is in the 90s, and it was for clubbing in France. And eventually I nannied in France. And I took that striped jumpsuit to the tiny little town where I was nannying. And babies and striped jumpsuits do not mix. But after college graduation, I got a job sewing clothes at this local clothing boutique called The Big Bang. And we used to make skirts out of plastic shower curtains. We had a bunch of 50s bullet bras, and we would decorate those with sequins for cross-dressers in the trans community. We made a ton of gothic velvet capes. Oh my goodness, this is the 90s in Portland. It was all goth. And Dr. Seuss hats. There was a lot of vintage 70s polyester, so we kind of made these 70s polyester shirts with zippers in the front. We did a lot of satin micro mini skirts and satin like bralette tops, and a lot of fake fur too. Fake fur tops, fake fur backpacks, fake fur skirts, and fake fur dresses. I remember having a leopard fake fur dress that I wore, and I wore that when my husband and I were dating, and I loved that dress. I loved that dress so much. Halloween at the Big Bang was nuts. We were working overtime. There was just three of us in the back just churning out stuff, and then we'd get, a bonus at the end, which was a big deal back then because, you know, when you're paid an hourly pittance for doing this, that was exciting to get the bonus. So at the time, you know, I used the industrial straight stitch and the industrial five cone serger. And we also used a vintage button holder for the clothes because that was just the easiest thing to do. And then the three of us behind the scenes who were making all these things, eventually we all started getting married. And so we all made our wedding gowns and I made mine. And then, you know, I eventually had my son, who was born 2.5 months prematurely. You know, full term is 40 weeks. He was a 29-weeker. And so he had a lot of medical issues. He continues to have medical issues. He's a preemie. He'll always be a preemie. And at the time, I was also in graduate school. And I wasn't going to give up graduate school. It was a scholarship. So I had to do that. So it was just like juggling my son in graduate school. But I remember during that time, I made the most insane make that you could ever think of because I just didn't have a lot of time. I made a corset, and it was out of silk, Dupiani, and I didn't have the right hardware or anything like that, but it was just, it was during a very stressful time when my son was a baby. You know, he would forget to breathe. And so I would have to resuscitate him, make him breathe. 911 was flagged on our phone, which is the emergency line, so that if we ever called, they would immediately dispatch an ambulance. We wouldn't have to speak. He did that a lot in the early months of his infancy, until, you know, his body just got used to breathing. But yeah, as my son got older, it just became easier to go to the thrift stores and refashion clothes than taking my son to the fabric store, where he would have a tantrum, most likely. There was a goal that I decided just to have, because we were trying to save money. We lived in a 1,000-square-foot condo. I just threw out 5 years without purchasing any new clothing except for underwear and shoes. I never even purchased underwear or shoes eventually. And after about 2.5 years, it got really old. And so I just worked through the closet of the clothes that I had. And because they were all thrifted clothes, they were all a little ratty anyway, so they started falling apart. So my final year, I had one outfit left. And I actually, I shouldn't say that. I had a pair of cords that, when I was ice skating with my son and his friends, they ripped. And so I had to go to the thrift store and get another pair of cords. But I had, it was a t-shirt that when I coached Little League t-ball, I had that t-shirt. I had an old thrifted Ralph Lauren sweater that I got for like $7. But it was beautiful with this chunky cable knits, and everybody always gave me compliments on it. It was hilarious. I wore it out for the whole 5 years, and I even had to stitch it down because it had started to unravel. So, and everything was gray, although the t-shirt had some purple and white, but the Ralph Lauren sweater was gray. My cords were gray, and my Converse sneakers that started to get holes in them were gray. So I totally dressed like a crayon for like, and it was a ratty crayon, like a crayon, like, you know, where you pull off you peel off the paper around it, whatever. I was the ratty, worn out crayon for a year, basically. But I was going to do my goal, you know. I was so close, so I had to do it. And friends started freaking out. They're like, "What are you doing? You know, just buy some clothes." And I was like, "No, I'm not going to do that." Yeah, it was so nice when it was finally done.
Oh my gosh. I mean, I have so many questions. I love that you were doing like a ready to wear fast before it was a trendy.
Yeah, before it was like a trend
in the sewing world. But yeah, this is so interesting. I mean, it sounds like sewing kind of followed you throughout your teen years and college and your adulthood. And I kind of love that you sort of kept coming back to it. And what brought you to Paris? I had no idea that you lived in France for a while.
I had saved up some money. My dad died when I was 9 years old, and it was through the VA. If you were a child of a parent who died when they were in the military, there was a certain amount of money that you could get monthly to go to school. And, you know, I mean, we grew up with a single mom who was from Bolivia who never finished college. And so it was just always a way just to find ways to make money or store money. So I would take that stipend that I would get, the monthly check stipend, and just squirrel it away. And it was good enough to pay for my college at the time and a little more. And then when I had enough money, and then of course, you know, my mom's garage was awesome. I mean, that, you know, I just open up the garage, sell a bunch of stuff, and there we go. That's my plane ticket. And I would literally pay for my plane ticket in a weekend. It was ridiculous. So my mom was just a natural thrifter. It wasn't like she was even like wanting to sell it. She would just find these beautiful things and just collect them. And then when I was there, I met a pregnant woman, and I realized, because I didn't want to go home, but I had to just for a little bit. But I met her. I asked her if she wanted a fille-au-pair, you know, a nanny. And she did. And so I finished my schooling that spring, went back home for the summer, opened up the garage again, made some more money to get my plane ticket back to France. And this was in the south of France. This was like a tiny, tiny town. In fact, I lived in a 500-year-old farmhouse that was made out of stone that scorpions lived in. And so occasionally scorpions would be on the floor and you just have to just slam them with a shoe. But yeah, so where was I going with that? Anyway, yeah, you wanted to know how I went to France. So yeah, so I was nannying this baby boy, you know, with my striped jumpsuit that didn't work out. So I never wore it until the very end when I had to catch the plane back to the U.S.
You are full of amazing stories, Denise. Oh. I feel like we could talk forever. Okay, let's bring it back to sewing, though.
Yes.
Because
yes.
I also loved hearing about your ready-to-wear fast and your yes. 5 years of not buying clothes. Were you sewing at all during that time, or were you also not allowed to sew yourself any new clothes?
Well, I did for the first 2.5 years. I was trying to refashion things and make them fun while I was dealing with my son, while I was still doing graduate school. So yeah, but it got tiresome buying clothes that were a little, where the fabric was a little bagged out. And it was just like, oh man, it would just be nice to get some real fabric. But I promised myself that I was going to do this. So anyway, like I said, after 2.5 years, I got really sick of it. And I was like, you know what? Forget this. I'm not going to fashion anymore. I got really busy with graduate school and my son, and I was just like, I'm just going to wear out my closet. So that's what happened. But I will tell you, the first outfit that I did buy afterwards, it was a silk tank and shorts. And it felt like gossamer on me. I was loved it so much. And I didn't even feel like I needed to buy anything else. Like, I wore that for the whole summer.
Oh my gosh. Amazing.
It's so inspiring, because I think as sewists, we have a little bit of an obsession with fashion and clothing, and we fill our closets with lots of beautiful handmade things. And it's really fun, but we can also get easily overwhelmed by that and end up with a lot of clothes. Maybe I'm just speaking for myself. And you don't necessarily need all those things, and you're proof of that. So thank you for sharing that story with us.
Oh, well, I'm proof that it changes too. Like, I did do capsule wardrobes for a long time. And then, after I got cancer, I was like, you know what? I'm just going to make everything. Who cares? Life is short. So yeah.
Well, let's talk about it, because as you mentioned, we're here to talk about sewing through cancer. And I'm sure that there are listeners out there right now who are battling with cancer or have loved ones who are battling with cancer. And we just want to send out a huge hug from all of us at Love to Sew to you, and aww, hope that this episode inspires some people out there. And yeah, so can you tell us a little bit about being diagnosed with breast cancer and what your experience was with cancer? Mm-hmm. Or is with cancer, I should say.
So my husband's the one who discovered the lump in my breast. He was just laying next to me in bed, as husbands do occasionally. He liked my breasts. So he reached over and grabbed it, and then he kept squeezing. I was like, stop, you know, what are you doing? He's like, what's this? And I was like, what do you mean, just stop? And he's like, no, what is this? Like, there's nothing there. What are you talking about? I thought he was joking. And he said, no, what is this? And I put my hand there, and I immediately jumped out of bed, because I had a golf ball in my breast. I had, from the 90s, they always used to have these little cards, you know, like the do not disturb on hotel doors, you know, where you put those little cards. You would put it over on the shower, and you would feel your breasts in the shower with your soapy water and all that. And it was a good time to do it. So that's how I learned to feel my breasts. And I would just do that in the shower, because I had a good friend who was part of our play group who had just been diagnosed with breast cancer 2 months prior. So of course I was feeling my breasts, but I was doing it in the wrong way. What you really need to do is lay down on the bed and lift your arm up on the side of the breast that you're going to feel, without any cream or anything. And my breast tissue was always very dense. Whenever I had mammograms, they always said, you know, we can't guarantee that we will ever find a cancer if it is there, because your breast tissue is very dense. But yeah, when we discovered it, it was the size of a golf ball. It was 4 centimeters. So I immediately got things rolling. I just called my doctor, and of course I couldn't get in that day, but I was just like, this is an emergency. I need to see him the next day. And because I had already had so much experience in the medical side of things with my son, it really helped me advocate for getting the things that I needed. So my doctor said, well, you know, we don't have we can do an x-ray like maybe 3 weeks from now. And I was like, no, it's going to be like this week and we're going to find another space. So I ended up going to another place where they did the ultrasound. And, you know, this was just happened very quickly within the week. And my husband was at work. You know, I didn't need him with me at this point. I was just like, let's just get this done. And immediately it looked like a black hole on the ultrasound. Did you guys ever see the solar eclipse, the full solar eclipse? It's beautiful, but one thing you will notice is that when the moon moves over the sun, it is the blackest black you've ever seen. And that's what it looked like in the ultrasound. It looked just like a black hole. She said it didn't look good. She needed to do a biopsy. And she's like, well, I could do it a week from now or we could do it right now. And I was like, we're doing it right now. You know, who cares? I don't need my husband with me. Let's just get this done. So yeah, I told my doctor, I said, I don't want to hear this from a nurse. I want you to be the one to call me and tell me what is going on. The odds of it being cancer were low because I was an outlier. I was 45 at the time. There are so many other things that can happen to the breast, cysts and whatever. And when I'd had my mammogram in October, and this was May, there was nothing there. They had seen a little cyst that was there, but it was fine, you know. So there was a thought that, okay, well, maybe it's the cyst that's gotten a little larger, but I didn't feel good about it. Nobody felt good about it. But my doctor was like, you know, we just don't know until we know. So then, yeah, he called me and told me what it was. And he sounded a little surprised as well. So it was stage two, even though it was that big, it was still stage two because they hadn't seen it go into the lymph nodes yet. Now the tissue is the issue. So you can never know anything until they actually remove that site. But it was stage two, grade three, triple negative breast cancer. That's what I had. And triple negative breast cancer typically comes with genetic mutations. So they immediately tested me for 9 different genetic mutations. We know the BRCA1 and the BRCA2. One of those is what Angelina Jolie has. But there's other genetic mutations that can cause breast and ovarian cancers. So I had to sign my life away because you're talking about your genes and we don't know what the implications of that are yet. Like, what do health insurances do with that? Like, once they know what your genes are, there's just all these unknowns about sharing your genes. So I didn't end up having any genetic mutations of those 9 variants. However, I will say this, my brother, who is almost 3 years younger than me, and he is now 45, he just got diagnosed with prostate cancer. And prostate cancer and breast cancer are linked. So there is a scorpion in our genes somewhere. It's not, you know, a fluke that this happened. So I had to tell my son and my niece and nephew, anytime you go to the doctor, you have to let them know exactly what your aunt and your dad or, you know, your mom and your uncle have had, because we were both outliers. We were both very young for this to happen. So treatment is just like a pregnancy and a delivery. No two are alike, and things regularly go off the rails from the standard that they tell you. So my treatment plan was supposed to look like 16 rounds of chemo, a surgery that would either be a unilateral mastectomy or a bilateral mastectomy at the time. Those were the two options I was given. And possible radiation depending on what the surgery unveiled. Then later, my treatment became a hysteroophorectomy. And that is because they found, when they did the full body scan, they found a mass that they thought was benign, but then when my oncologist took it to the tumor board said it's not behaving, it doesn't look like it's behaving normally. So I had to see a gyn-onc. And because of my age and because the results from the genetic testing were 3 weeks out, so I wasn't going to get those back, they thought that maybe I had one of those BRCA genes where I was having breast cancer at the same time that I was having ovarian cancer. So they had to take everything out. So, That became part of my treatment plan, was that first. And then that was shown to be benign because they needed to look at it. And that was the only way that they were going to be able to look at it. Because if you tried to just take it out that one little ovary, you could seed the potential cancer into other areas of your body. So you can't do it. It has to be safely done. So you have to pack it into a little bag, which was my uterus. But anyway, yeah, I did have my chemotherapy. I ended up having 15 rounds and I had to have a reduction in some of the chemo drugs because I kept becoming neutropenic, which is very low white blood cell count. Some people are admitted to the ER when this happens. I was never admitted to the hospital because I managed to be fine, but I had to really stay at home and just kind of avoid the public because I would just get everything. So therefore, my chemotherapy took 1 month longer because they had to keep postponing my infusions. So yeah, it was just a time of a little torturous. Like, it's like, this is going to last another week and then another week, really. And then at the end, because the chemo did such a good job dissolving my tumor, I was also given the choice to have a lumpectomy with radiation if I wanted to. So if you have a lumpectomy, you have to have radiation. There's no either or with that. It's a both and. So like the day to day while I was in treatment, like I had to drink 12 glasses of water per day. All of you guys who haven't had breast cancer, you probably just think of the bald and vomiting woman. And there's a lot more that goes into it. So for example, you know, I had to drink 12 glasses of water every single day because if I didn't, the chemicals from the chemo could burn my bladder. And if I saw coffee grounds in the toilet, then I would know that my bladder was burned. I have to brush my teeth after putting any single amount of food in my mouth or else I could get mouth sores. You can't cut yourself. There's no nicks or mouth biting or anything because then bacteria can get into your body. And because chemo is just destroying those fast growing cells, which includes the cancer, but it also includes you. It's trying to kill you. It's playing chicken with, is it going to kill the cancer first or you? So your white blood cell count goes down. So any bacteria that gets in there can become serious. I think of it, when I eventually got out of chemo, three weeks after I got out of chemo, I watched Stranger Things for the first time. You know that show, Stranger Things? The upside down is chemo. That's how you view the world when you're on chemo. So like I said, I was neutropenic, which meant I had very low white blood cell count. The nausea, when you're infused, it feels like liquid mercury seeping into your stomach. I'd never vomited, but and if you don't know that feeling of liquid mercury seeping into your stomach, I would just say when you're at the grocery store, just go ahead and look at the rows of bottles of bleach and just grab one and chug it. And that's kind of the nausea that you would be thinking of when that's how I was feeling. There's a loss of taste because the taste buds are a faster growing cell. So immediately after you get infused, things, you just can't taste anything. So it's all texture. And then it slowly comes back and then you get bombed again with the chemo. So for example, French fries literally tasted like chalk. And I got all my taste back after the 5 months of chemo. And so therefore like chips, salty chips were too salty. They were like a salt lick, and a cookie was so sweet. It was like a sugar cube. It was too intense. So it took me a while to get back to just eating regular foods. You know, I was very fatigued. I napped twice a day. There was a constant vibration in my body that coffee can't even touch, like to show you an example of what it was like. You're very noisy. There's just this hum in your body and you don't like it. And also with that, that was a little surprising that I didn't realize until after I was out of chemo, is that you stop hearing your heartbeat and you don't think about it, but that's really a part of who you are. And that goes silent because the chemo makes the heart squeeze less and you don't realize it until it comes back in full force. And then you're like, oh, I feel like I'm getting myself back. My eyes were constantly bloodshot and weepy. It was difficult to focus. I still chemo wrecked my eyes. I need to deal with glasses. Constant runny nose. Neuropathy is a big one. And this is a big one for SOAST. It's permanent nerve damage to the ends of your fingers or your toes so that you can't feel anything. And that made me very nervous. For whatever reason, I only felt like little firework sparks on the tips of my fingers a couple times during the end of my infusions. So it didn't get to me, but it does get to some people, and it becomes very hard to do fine motor things. I had to wear panty liners for 3 months from my surgery spotting because I was chemoed a week after surgery. And because chemo is constantly killing your cells, you're not healing as fast. My skin was very thin and sensitive, so it would break out, it would bruise, cut, blister easily, like on walks. My heels would sometimes get a blister, or my toes would get a blister just from going on walks. But I needed to exercise. You have to avoid the sun too, because your skin's very sensitive. My ears, my inner ears were scabbed from wearing earplugs. Just the earplug pressure scabbed my ears. Occasionally I'd see blood on my sheets and pillowcases, and that sounds more dramatic than it was. But and I ended up getting mouth sores too, and they went down my throat. I had chemo brain, which still is long lasting and probably permanent. You just get really forgetful. So I have all these notes around me right now to help me remember everything, and so I can remember words. But I have to say, while occasionally it has made me a little scared, it's been quite peaceful to have chemo brain because you're in the present moment. You're not thinking too much of other things. Like, for example, when I went to the pharmacy, I just needed to get two things. I thought, oh, I don't need to write that down on my notes on my phone. I remember this. And then I saw chocolate bars. And I was like, oh, chocolate. Well, yeah, let me get some chocolate. The Cadbury chocolate's really good. You know, oh yeah, I haven't had that in a long time. And I completely forgot. I was like, I think I need something else, but I can't remember. But one of my armors was a handmade shirt that I wore to every infusion.
The same shirt every time.
Mm-hmm. The same outfit every time.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your treatment journey with us. I mean, you've been through an incredible amount. And the only question really in my mind right now is, how does anyone get through this? Like, just hearing about it, it's overwhelming just hearing about it. And I can't imagine going through it. Where were you at mentally during that time? Like, were you pushing through to the end fully, like, you know, sure that you were going to get through this, so you were going to beat cancer? Or where, you know, you must have had days where you were doubtful. Like, talk to us a little bit about that side of things.
Yeah. Well, during treatment and because of the chemo brain, and because you feel so bad, insert wide-eyed poo emoji, that's how you feel. you don't necessarily think too much about what is happening. You're just like, okay, I'm in treatment. They're helping me. It's going to be fine. And you literally just look out the window and watch the birds. And you lay in bed and you fall asleep. And when you're infused, and I call it the chemo tunnel, when you decline, because you decline after, I think mine was after about day four was when I really started declining. And you're in this horrible space for about 4 days before you come up again. You can't really think everything else that's going on. I know my husband and my son did, but I didn't. It was only after, when I got my wits a little more about me, that you come up for air, and then you're just like, oh, insert wide-eyed poo emoji, what's going to happen now?
So let's bring it back to sewing here, because yes. I know that you did sew throughout your treatment with cancer. So can you tell us a little bit about how you made space for sewing?
Yeah. Okay. So like I said, chemo is noisy. I couldn't listen to podcasts or listen to music or watch TV or movies. It was just too much of an assault. And I wanted to stay quiet, even though my body was constantly in this vibrating mode that I wanted to walk away from. And my worst days, which I have said, you know, is like right after the infusion, you start declining, like day four, and you go into this awful tunnel where you just want to walk outside of yourself. I had to distract myself. So I would go into my sewing room. And because I couldn't really think, I just took out my bag of scraps. And I was laying in my sewing room, just sorting out scraps, feeling terrible. My husband walked in. He was laughing. He was like, what are you doing? Because I was just laying on the floor. Just like, ugh. I was like, I'm sorting scraps. And that's all I could tell him. I'm just sorting scraps. And it felt good to just sort scraps into different piles of colors. then I decided, you know what, I'm going to make the scrap quilt that I always envisioned I would make. This is the time for it now. And I could tolerate the hum of the sewing machine. That felt good. And that was enough. And it felt good. And it felt like I was doing something. So it was really a pathetic escape. Like I would grab two scraps. I'd grab part of a pile, just put it right next to me on the table. Just grab two scraps. Literally, it was very mechanical. Sandwich two scraps together, lift up the presser foot, put it down, put down the presser foot, stitch, you know, lift up the presser foot, cut, it was done. And if I could just go through those steps, then I would start to get lost in the sewing. And yeah, that really helped me. And so I did make this huge, giant scrap quilt ultimately. Yeah, it was a flurry of doctors and scans and whatever. And then once I started, and then, you know, the surgery, and then I had to recover from that. And then once I was into chemo, and I realized after that first infusion, I don't know how I'm going to survive this. So I had to think of something to distract me from all that noise and that god-awful tunnel that I knew I was going to go into every single time I was infused. So, I have a blog where I wrote about all of this. If anybody's interested, it's called, I'm a little irreverent. My husband is too. It's called My Evil Tit blogspot.blogspot.com.
Yeah, we'll definitely link it, because the quilt that you're referencing, the one that you made when you were going through chemo, you called it the chemo tunnel. And yes, it's amazing. Mm-hmm. It's really something. So we'll have to link it in the show notes so our listeners can take a look at that. And you also just mentioned that quilt project for your friend. Do you want to tell us the story of that?
Yeah. So my friend had died a year prior to my diagnosis. And she was, just to give you some context, she was a new mom at the school. And I saw her at back to school night. And it was second grade, and she just had this really big smile on her face. And I just remember thinking, I want to get to know her. That's the person I want to get to know. So I invited her son to have a play date with my son, and we talked, and she was just as irreverent as me. And she was light and had a great sense of humor. And she had just ended her treatment for colon cancer. And she wasn't bald, but her hair looked thin. It was a different kind of treatment. And she was cancer-free for about a year before it returned. And At the time, I didn't understand that it meant that she was dying. She didn't really talk about it that way. But when I realized that she was, and when some of the other moms did, you know, we all wanted to help. But she really just wanted to have just a typical life before she died. And so I talked to her about making some quilts for her kids, and she liked that idea. We went out a couple times, and she was just irreverent and funny with her cancer. Even though she was dying, she was so irreverent. And, you know, we just hung out and talked. And so she died in May, a year prior to my diagnosis. And so that summer, I organized a bunch of the kids to help sew the quilts for her children. And her children selected her clothes from her closet and put them in bags. And I went over to her house, and, you know, we unfolded the clothes and looked at them, and, you know, and the kids said, okay, this is the one I want on my quilt, and these are the ones that I don't. And so I had two piles, one for her daughter, one for her son. And her son selected six kids to work on his quilt. And I would organize them to come over to the house with her son. And they'd play and do Nerf gun wars and swing on the hammock. And we'd stitch and we'd cut. And it was just all kind of meshed together. Just a big jumble. And her daughter wanted her entire class to work on hers. So, you know, I emailed the parents of that class, and we just set up times during that summer after her death where kids would come, and I'd show them how to use the just the scissors to cut and the rotary blade. Oh my goodness. That was big. That was a big one. They loved that as a pizza cutter, you know, so it was like pizza cut the fabric. So, so they cut the fabric and then I'd show them, you know, okay, this is how you do it under the machine, and they'd stitch, and it was exciting for them. And the quilt tops were almost done. They were basically done when I was diagnosed with my cancer. And, I couldn't even look at them. It's just like, my God, you know, I had sold to the parents and to the kids that we were filling them with friendship and love and support. And, here it was, I had cancer, and how could I work on these? Because I was going to be filling them with more cancer. It was just an irony, but one of my friends actually told me, when I was like, I'm just filling these things with cancer, more cancer. And she said, no, you're filling them with your survival. And so it gave me the permission that I needed to continue working on them for my friend who had died. So, so I did. So while I was feeling really bad, I was working on my quilt with the scraps, and I started taking some of her clothes that were scraps from her kids' quilt projects and incorporating those into mine. And with her kids, I just tied the quilts together and did the binding, and I had to finish that because I had promised that I would do that within the year so that they would have them, their quilts, a year after her death. That was going to be the deadline, but it took longer. And I finished those quilts for her when I felt good, a little better. I just work on them.
It's such a beautiful way to remember somebody, and especially for the children, I'm sure, to have that physical memory of her. And I'm sure, you know, the smell and all those things that would be in her clothes that would be so special for them. And what a beautiful gift for you to give them. And I think your friend's right about you filling them with survival. It's an amazing way to put it. And there's a whole blog article about this project as well, which we'll link. And you can see pictures of the kids sewing, and it's very cute.
Yeah.
So one of the things that comes to mind for me is how your cancer diagnosis and sewing through cancer has sort of changed your sewing practice, or perhaps changed the way that you approach sewing or the types of projects that you want to do. Has that been kind of a transition for you, like sewing pre-cancer versus sewing post-cancer?
Well, right now, I mean, my body is in so much change and upheaval that it's all kind of looser garments and a lot of knits. So that's my sewing. As far as like a practice, I'm definitely making more time for it than I did before because life is short. So during the evenings, not all evenings, I will sew and just kind of have a nice peaceful time in the sewing room and listen to my Audible. But I go through sewing jags. I'll sew and then I won't, you know, when my cup is full, and I'll work on other things that fill me. And then when my sewing cup gets a little empty, I'll work to fill it up again. I know people talk about the sojo. I find it more like breathing. It's just an ebb and flow. It's just my hobby's rhythm, and we all have one.
Mm-hmm. What about making decisions in the sewing room as far as what fabrics you're going to use? Do you find yourself using those precious fabrics? Like you said, life is short. So do you go for those ones that have been in your stash for a while?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. If I find something, I'm like, yeah, I need to use this. So, yeah, there's nothing sacred in the sewing room. It's all up for grabs. It's all mine. My pretties. So.
I think we can all take a little page out of your book there. Yeah. If you wouldn't mind chatting a bit about the changes that you've been through, your body in particular, you mentioned is changing so much and continuing to change. And how is that impacting your fashion, the way you dress, what you want to sew, what you want to wear, the way you want to present yourself?
Well, yeah, I wish I had like a neat, clean answer, because it's not necessarily an either or statement, because that turns one decision or lifestyle into a good and the other into a bad. I'm a fan of both and. And so I might contradict myself with this. So I guess maybe first, just if I could give you an analogy of what this means to have your body change so dramatically because of cancer, that might help. And I know that body changes can carry a lot of judgment, but I think I have an analogy that is also personal and emotional, but it removes a lot of the judgment. So let's say you're diagnosed with cancer and you will die unless you do one of three options. One, you get a crew cut. Two, you get a mohawk. Or three, you get a mullet. And you currently have a bob, and that's always been you, and you've always had the bob. So whatever you decide will be for the rest of your life. And you might be able to make another change to another of the two options later, maybe, perhaps, but that's what you get to choose. And some of you will get 1 week to make that choice, and others will get 5 months of treatment where you're pumped full of drugs and anti-nausea meds and steroids, and then you get to make that choice. So what do you choose? Go. In my breast cancer group, where we meet, every single person has done something different with their breasts. Not one choice is a panacea. So I can talk about the pros and cons of my choice very honestly. And I don't mean to judge those who made another choice or to demean those who've made a similar choice to mine, but it's just what happened. And I can talk about just kind of my body changes that have happened. So during chemo, like I started out, I lost 5 pounds, then I went back to baseline, then I gained 15. Post chemo, I lost the 15 because a lot of it was just steroids and water. But then I gained back 10 because I'm also in menopause and my body weight is still fluctuating. And menopause plays a role. And the doctors also play a role, because there's two things that I am now mandated to do. And one thing will feel personal, and I hope the other will alleviate that. So one, and this, just roll your eyes, I got to keep my weight down. I've got to keep my fat in check, because fat cells create and store hormones. And this is for women who have had breast cancer. I just want to make that clear. A lot of women can take the medications that stop the hormone production, or at least block it from getting around those areas where breast cancer might recur, because breast cancer feeds off hormones. Certain kinds of breast cancer feeds off hormones. There's one that feeds off a protein, and because mine is triple negative, they don't know what it feeds off of. So I don't have any kind of medications to help me. But they still get nervous, so they still want me to keep my weight down, and they still don't want me to do hormone therapy or anything like that, because it is linked to breast cancer. I also have to, this is number two, I have to exercise 30 minutes, 5 to 6 times a week, and get sweaty. And that's because studies have demonstrated, and this is my breast surgeon told me this, she's like, exercise is, they found it's just as equally as good as chemo. You need to start doing this, you know, 3 to 5 to 6 times a week. And my oncologist said the same thing. She was just like, that's the one where studies have demonstrated that it provides a reduction and a whole host of other cancers, regardless of weight, but just exercising. And so now we probably have all the personal trainers and the runners, whatever, are just like jumping for joy saying, yeah, we told you, you know, but yeah, it's exercise is the big one. They haven't really had any studies talk about sugar. And I know that that's probably adversarial, but I'm just going with what the doctors have told me and best practices. But, you know, ironically, menopause and the medicines that my friends are taking make you gain weight. So I had a double D cup before I had my mastectomy. And I wasn't always a double D. I think when I got married, I was probably a B/C cup. But, you know, it was just gradually over time, my breasts just got larger, and after I had my son and whatever. And so I was supposed to do, when I just elected to do reconstruction, that was my, I was like a crew cut or whatever. You know, I decided to do that because it got me closer to feeling like I was having, I have a bob. I mean, that's the whole goal. It's like, what makes you feel most like you, even though you'll never get there? What is that thing that makes you have, feel like you're wearing the bob and not the mohawk or the mullet or the crew cut? I had expanders put in and they would fill it with 50 cc's each time. And I was supposed to go larger to a C cup, but I only did 4 fills because I didn't like it at all. The whole thing sucked. So I went smaller, and my exchange surgery, I elected, you know, they show you all these different boobs. These foobs is what they're called. I elected to have a teardrop shaped implant put into me, and it has a nubby texture just to keep it in place because I thought it would look more natural. And this was elected. I actually paid to have a little bit of lipo done to my belly because I was trying to get back to my original silhouette. It's just going back to that bob, whatever your silhouette was before. So I lived with those implants for a while. It's just kind of like a wearable muslin. You end up viewing your body like a garment because you have to try to make it as comfortable as possible and as wearable as possible. So I've got an appointment with my plastic surgeon on Friday, and we're going to discuss options because it just doesn't feel comfortable. I mean, if I'm supposed to have these for the rest of my life, I need to feel comfortable. You know, a dress needs to fit. So it's this absurdity of life. Like, I never thought I'd go to a plastic surgeon's office requesting to see my past boobs and my new boobs. And I'm going to bring my seam gauge to like measure them and discuss the future plan. But like with my plastic surgeon, you know, she sews bodies, I sew clothes. I remind her of that all the time. So we can talk about this like pretty honestly and openly. And I am able to connect and disconnect from my body in a way. And that's because of sewing.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask next, is just, it's interesting, these connections that you're making between sewing and the surgeries that you're getting. And I can imagine that if you hadn't been a sewist and you hadn't been measuring your body your whole life and planning clothes and just being really familiar with, you know, every inch of yourself, that it might be more difficult to make those connections or to think of it in that way. That's a little bit more analytical and just, yeah, I got to make this new sort of skin work for me.
Exactly. But sewing has been a lifesaver in so many ways. Like I do tell my breast surgeon, like I said, every single time, I sew, I understand this. I know there's certain things that you can do that you can't do, that some things are going to look a little wonky just because it's a handmade body. I mean, you're the one who's stitching it. And I actually like those little wonky things because it reminds me of her. It's her work. But yeah, the sewing has definitely helped me to thrive post-cancer just because I can connect very much to my body and also disconnect and look at it like a garment. Sometimes I just think of myself as that, what was it, that Nightmare Before Christmas, that the girlfriend, the doll who's constantly having body parts fall off and then she stitches them together. I need her in my sewing room. But yeah, I've told my breast surgeon, I'm like, I'm kind of kicking myself that I asked for a little bit of larger boobs because I know that my shoulders are narrow and small and sloped. And so it doesn't give me a lot of room between my armpits and my breasts where they jut out. Like, there's not a lot of room. So it's crowded in there. So I'm able to tell her that. Mm-hmm. So it's both very zen and emotional. It's zen because I can compartmentalize it and remove my body from myself and look at it as a garment that I need to wear because it's reconstruction and my plastic surgeon is the tailor. But it's also very emotional. I cried for 3 weeks after my last exchange surgery because it's just a different body again. Mm-hmm. And it just brought up so much. So like one of my friends is flat, you know, but she's not flat really. She is concave and she says that. So it's been very difficult. And this is Sky Labeled. I'm going to say her name because she wanted me to say her name. She's dying. She's stage 4 dying. But she just says that it's hard to find tops, ready-to-wear tops that fit her concave chest. It's kind of more of a triangular shape, of the, like you're thinking of like sewing. You know, it just goes in. Your arm size is much higher because breast tissue isn't just in front. It's also on the sides, and it's up higher on your chest than you would ever think. So when they do a mastectomy, a radical mastectomy, they're scraping it all out and trying to get every single last bit out. I don't even know where I was going with this, but there's just different choices, and it just is what it is.
Yeah. And I really like that you made the point of saying that for everyone, the choice is going to be different, and there isn't a right or wrong answer. There's only your answer and your solution. I think that's really important in anything in life, you know. I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on general dissatisfaction with figure mm-hmm. or bodies, because I think there's some of that in all of us in our day-to-day. And
yes.
And how do you feel about that now, having been through what you've been through and now having some reconstructive surgery? Do you have a new perspective on figuring out how to be okay with your body as it is, or learning how to love yourself the way you are, or whether or not it's, you know, it's okay to feel dissatisfied sometimes?
Yeah. So, you know, again, I don't have a clean answer. I wish I had this profound statement for all of you who have your bobs, you know, your beautiful, uneven, disheveled, healthy bobs, you know, that you can still swing it in the sunlight. You know, your bobs are so beautiful and don't even know it. You know, all of those unlikable parts are our body's personality. And I know that we know this. Like when Uncle Eddie, for example, comes walking up the street with legs so bowed that you can see the entire neighborhood between them. We know those legs and we love and adore them. And like if Uncle Eddie got them corrected to be straight because, you know, maybe it hurt his knees or his hips or just because he wanted to, I think we'd all grieve a little bit that a little bit of him was lost. And that's how my husband felt about my body. You know, your unlikable parts are so unique and beautiful to you. I mean, all you have to do is just picture your friends, the way they stand, the way they walk in their bodies. And it's all those different parts that are so unique and beautiful to them. Everybody stands and walks differently, but you know, you just get so connected to those beloved, unique, and beautiful people. And it's funny because the way that you view them is the way that they view you. So it is kind of a loss when you just have like a whole frontal kind of body lobotomy of some kind where it's just like, okay, this is very different. And some of that was my choice too. I used to be so confident about how my body would age, like where I'd sag and droop and puff up. And, you know, none of us know that anymore in our breast cancer group. We're all still kind of stunned because the change has happened so abruptly. So our brains still need to catch up. Post-mastectomy, for example, I had phantom boobs and I had a phantom cancer. So I would lay down in bed and I could feel my boobs pancake out to their sides, but they weren't there. It was just these fake little Barbie missiles. When I'd run, I swear I could feel the heft of those boobs, and I'd have to put on a sports bra just so they could feel like I was containing it. But I didn't need to, and it took a while for my brain to catch up with that. And the cancer, I could feel it cramping and everything inside my hollow, fake, filled expander. But it wasn't there. And it just took a while for my brain to catch up. So it'll just take a while for my brain to catch up with everything that's been done to me right now. But our bodies will age and change because of that aging. And it really does mean that you're older and that you're still here. And my chest will never change. It will eventually look weird and awkward. I mean, I will, if I am so lucky, I will be the grandma who sits at the Thanksgiving table with 20-year-old boobs that's nipping out because I don't have to wear a bra. And it's just going to be a little weird. You know, I would just say celebrate your body's health. Celebrate it if it allows you to run, jump, stand, or just eat. You know, I have two friends who've died of breast cancer and three more who are slowly dying. And if you don't like your body, I'm sure they would gladly exchange their dying bodies for your healthy, unlikable one. And I would love to do that for them. I mean, I really would do anything to get my old body back, all of it, even its unlikable parts. And I say this knowing that it's idealistic to love like every inch of us, because there's no need to feel guilty for disliking certain areas because that are different. You know, I mean, right now I hate my genes. I distrust my cells. And I just feel like all feelings are feelings, and fear and dissatisfaction are also perfectly normal. And we can still thrive despite them. Nothing is ever perfect, and thriving is more important than reaching that ideal of 100% self-love, you know, whatever you can get to, just as long as you're content and satisfied and you're thriving. But I do love Instagram, everybody posting in their clothes, because for so long, it just seems like the tail has been wagging the dog in regards to advertisers and their ideal body type. And I really feel like it's slowly changing. Like it seems to be that there's this upwelling from the ground up. People are the ones who make the change. And I think of Margaret Mead, that cultural anthropologist. You know that her famous quote, "Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has." We're doing that. So just keep on posting, dudes, dudettes, people. Because together we're making strides. We're part of a movement. And every single robot you can imagine on Instagram is pointed at us right now, absorbing our information and making algorithms. So feed those robots your beautiful selves.
Feed those robots.
Just feed the robots you, who you are now.
Oh, Denise, thank you so much. I mean, it really puts things in perspective hearing you talk about it like that. And I'm sure our listeners are going to feel the same way.
Oh, thanks.
Speaking of our listeners, because I do know there are bound to be listeners out there who are battling with cancer themselves or have a loved one who's going through something similar. And we were wondering if you had anything that you'd like to say to them.
I'm going to say another quote. There's that Eleanor Roosevelt quote where she said, "You must do the thing you think you cannot do. And eventually we all will be there." I've said this to one person before, but you know, you just grab and pull, because eventually you'll find yourself out of that deep chasm that you're in, and just keep at it. And you keep grabbing and pulling, and eventually you'll find yourself on top of a mountain. For breast cancer, people who have any kind of cancer, breast cancer, whatever your difficulties are, you know, I can say wholeheartedly that we are here for you always. You know, during your difficult moments, we'll be holding your hand. Just feel us. We're there.
Thank you. Are there any sewing groups or hashtags that you have been involved in since you were diagnosed with cancer?
I haven't, but part of it for me is when I was going through my treatment, I called one breast cancer survivor, and she said, "There will come a time when you will forget you've ever had cancer." And she was 6 years out, and she had had reconstruction. And so, not that other people cannot forget, but I just felt for me, for part of my thriving, it would help me to have some reconstruction so that when I got naked, was in the shower, it would seem like I had those body parts back, and that maybe one day I would actually be able to come to a space where I could actually just forget it for 24 hours. I can't imagine that right now, but that's my goal, just to be able to just forget it for just 24 hours. So I haven't participated because everybody has a different way of how they need to heal and thrive. So some of my friends are very active in the breast cancer community, I just have my small group of breast cancer friends. We love each other. I love that we're all different, that we've all made different choices, and we're all very honest.
I do think that you have made a contribution to the sewing world in your own way through your writing, through your words. And I know for us, whenever we get emails from people that are struggling with breast cancer, we always direct them towards your work.
Oh, wow.
Because it is so beautiful and moving. So we're definitely going to link your work with The Socialists and Seamwork Magazine in the show notes and encourage everyone to go and check that out. Helen and I are both very moved right now, and we want to thank you for being so open with us about your experience, because clearly it was, you know, such a huge part of your life, and it still is, and we're just really thankful that you agreed to come and talk to us about it.
Well, thank you. I didn't realize that my writing touched you that much and that you would use it as a resource. That makes me feel really good. Thank you.
No problem. So we do want to touch a little bit on some of the other things you have going on, mainly the People's Sewing Army.
Yeah.
So I don't know if this is an awkward transition, but no. Maybe let's talk about that a little bit. Could you tell our listeners what that's all about?
Okay, yeah. So the People's Sewing Army is a collective of sewists who feel compelled to repurpose the scrap fabric and donate it to individuals and organizations in need. So it's by the people for the people. And the mission is simple. We reuse our sewing scraps for good causes. That's it. And our main value, these are what I made up, is we love our planet and the people on it. So the first step is just to join. Just on Instagram. And that one is simple. And then the second step is to act. But there's no obligation for anybody to act. You simply act when you're moved to do so. And I just post missions. And what you put into the sewing army is really up to you.
It's such an amazing concept. And I know our listeners are going to be so excited because they love ideas for things to do with their scraps, because nobody knows what to do with their scraps.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And they love making a difference in the world, and especially environmentally as well. So what are some of the missions that you guys have done so far?
Okay. Yeah. So the first mission, I mean, this is in its infancy. So the first mission was making Christmas toys for the community transitional school. And that's a school for homeless kids. And I've always worked in the nonprofit sector, so I know a lot of the organizations that are around in my community. So anyway, so this is a school for homeless kids. And these kids, you know, they live in either DV shelters, domestic violence shelters, or under bridges, or their families are surfing on couches, or they're living in their cars. And it's a private school, and buses do come to pick them up at their various locations and drive them to school. And there are volunteer dentists and optometrists who come to check up on the kids. The kids are offered free breakfasts and lunches, and they're given dinners to take home to their families. And the school also offers like a volleyball sports team, and after school clubs, because these are things that homeless kids and families who move around a lot never really get to participate in. So it was just a way that was the first mission that I launched, and it was toys for their Christmas celebration, because these kids do feel removed from these American traditions, and the school wants to celebrate them in order to reignite their excitement and make the students feel like they play a vital role in the community as worthy citizens who eat, sing, and dance together, that are not just always on the fringes of society. So that one was the first one. And I knew that was going to be very popular because this is a very moving organization. And oh, yeah, it was amazing. Like the amount of toys that people were able to create out of their scrap fabrics and how beautiful they made them. And they stuffed them with scraps and everything that they did. I was blown away with the love and the creativity and the giving of everybody. Just the giving of their time to do this for these kids. And then the second mission that we did is that we made pride patches and boas and, you know, fabric boas and bow ties and matching hankies for SMRC kids. That's the Sexual and Gender Minority Youth Resource Center. And that place has been around for 20 years. In its infancy, it was a private little thing. where it was a rec center in which gay, lesbian, and questioning teens could hang out after school on Friday nights. And it has subsequently grown. It's absorbed into another nonprofit organization now, but they offer educational workshops, mental health services, empowering activities for the sexual and gender minority population. And so Pride Patches were just kind of suggested. I talked to one of the staff members there for the youth to kind of reclaim their pride as valued human beings who deserve to live freely and without fear, because this was during the time when the Trump administration, specifically the Department of Health and Human Services, was trying to legally define gender, as a biological condition determined at birth. And when you're talking about queer youth, the Trevor Project has some pretty stark statistics that queer youth seriously contemplate suicide at almost 3 times the rate of heterosexual youth. And 92% of transgender youth have attempted suicide at least once before the age of 25.
Wow.
So we need to support them. So they felt the love. And so many people came out to send just incredible patches. I mean, I have mine on the blog that I posted, and it's totally wonky and gross and whatever. But, you know, it's cool because you can just sew that patch onto your backpack or your jeans, and it looks kind of cool in a grungy way. But people really went all out. They made gorgeous patches. I couldn't believe it. They were incredible. And then the bow ties and the matching hankies and the boas, those also were there for the kids just to grab and wear. So they were blown away. Everybody at SMRC was just, it felt really good. They just said, you know, we normally get like money or, you know, support and volunteer services, but never, never, ever like this. So it made them feel very, very loved. And the current mission right now is making napkins for the staff at the Audubon Society, because they would like to stop using paper napkins. So they'll keep all those napkins in-house at the Audubon Society, but also quilts for the birds that are recovering in their wildlife care center. The Audubon Society has a long, deep history, but it was established in 1886 at first. But did you know that it was established because of hunting birds, but also because of fashion?
No.
Yeah, which just kind of blew me away. Like, I had no idea. If you're talking about 1886, what were the women wearing? Feathers all over their hats and some of their garments. Huh. So these birds were being killed for that. And so it was a group of women who actually pulled it up and brought it to the forefront. Like, it kind of had a little bit of a blip for a second with these men. And the pledge was, you know, we will not molest birds. But then it was this group of women that were like, you know what? Why are we wearing all these feathers? So the Wildlife Care Center in Portland, Oregon is the oldest and busiest wildlife rehab facility in Oregon. And it's one of the busiest care centers in the U.S. So every year it treats about 3,000 animals for release back into the wild, not just birds, but everything. And it responds to more than like 10,000 wildlife-related inquiries. And it's open 7 days a week. And the goal is just to give injured native wildlife a second chance at life in the wild. So they've treated a ton of different animals, from bats to owls to skunks to, you know, turtles, chipmunks. But they've even performed surgery on a bear there, which is pretty wild.
Wow.
And this is the crazy thing. It's only operated by 3 staff. Yeah, that includes a veterinarian, but it's more than 100 volunteers who make up the difference, and they log over 48,000 hours a year. But because it's a nonprofit, and I worked in the nonprofit sector, this sounds all fancy and wonderful. It's, yeah, I mean, everything is just kind of rustic, should we say. And right now they just have old kind of ripped up towels for the birds to recover on. You know, and if we can use some of our scrap fabric and they can receive it and feel the love that other people really support them, then it just kind of gives a nice, homey, loving vibe in your chest. You just feel all warm. So there's a lot of stipulations to those quilts, though, because we're dealing with birds. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of funny and cute in some ways. And it's just, you know, it's just they have to advocate for the birds. So yeah, that's the current mission. I don't know how popular it's going to be. We'll see.
Oh, I mean, I think this is amazing. And I hope that there are listeners out there that want to make quilts for birds.
Who wouldn't? I
If anybody out there is wondering how they can like actually join in and participate, where can they get all the details for that?
It's on Instagram. At the People Sewing Army.
Awesome.
And then once they finish their project, how does it work? Do they mail it directly to the organization that they're making it for?
Yes, they do. And so that's the part where they're going to have to invest a little bit of their money into making this happen. But, you know, I just think that, you know, when you're talking about garbage and scraps that end up in the landfill, they're moved around regardless. But this is where they're going to have to make a little bit of investment into mailing things.
Well, you can mail it, you know, snail mail if you want. It'll get there eventually.
Yeah, there's no deadline on this. I mean, I have a deadline so that we can start the next one, but there's no actual deadline on this one.
I just love how you are doing different projects. It's not just one thing for one particular charity or nonprofit. You kind of have new projects that come up and you're working on new things all the time for the People Sewing Army. So I think it's such a great cause. And I love what you said about how it's kind of sending like a little piece of magic out there. I think a lot of the time, you know, you think about sewing something with scraps and you're like, oh, I just need to get rid of my scraps. But it really is just this gift that you can give to an organization that needs it through, you know, the craft of sewing. And not everybody can sew. So we really do have these magic fingers and magic machines that can do amazing things. So I hope people are inspired to participate.
Yeah. And I honestly was thinking that some of the napkins were just going to be scraps that were just sewed up, you know, around the edges. But one person, I mean, I've been so touched by how much love they're putting into this. One person has embroidered each one individually.
Wow.
It just, it's so meaningful. And they're going to feel that. And they give love to animals. They it's just going to make them all warm and cozy inside.
That is so awesome. Thanks for sharing about that. And we will, of course, link everything in the show notes so that our listeners can get on that and get involved. But Denise, thank you for coming on and chatting with us today. It was such a great conversation. We're so thankful for you. Can you tell our listeners where they can find you online?
Yeah, I am at pimp_slapped. And
okay, hold on a second. You have to tell us the story behind your Instagram.
Oh, okay. So I've had lots of questions about it, and let's unpack it because it does trigger some people. So let's unpack Pimp Slapped. Okay. And you know, I've never been able to really fully explain it because it would just take way too long to do that on Instagram. It would just go into the comments and whatever. So I've been really lame when people have asked, well, why do you have this? And I've given a very vague and a small response when this has now given me an opportunity to really explain it. I write and I'm irreverent. So it's going to attract irreverent people. Rap music played a big role during my treatment, just for whatever reason. It kept popping up when I was even in the donut being, you know, x-rayed. Somebody was playing rap for me. And I hated rap. I always hated rap music and gangster rap. But I've come to absolutely love it. And I don't know if it's because my estrogen levels are lower, but I really love the old school gangster rap now. I listen to it all the time. And so you hear the word pimp in there. And then Kurt Vile had a song called Pretty Pimpin'. And I really liked that song. And so I was thinking, okay, well, where does this come from? So the etymology of pimp actually is well-dressed, dressing elegantly. So it's pimpé, pimpin, it's French, 16th century. And so I looked for an Instagram handle and I saw Pimp Slap. And the slap part was an active verb. So I imagine a slap. It's more active than just pimp. And I've been pimp slapped by cancer. But my question to you, and then I pose to everybody else, but who's really doing the slapping if this is about clothes and being well-dressed? Perhaps it's me slapping you with my outfits. So that is kind of where I come from. That's my little secret part. And it's always been there, and I've always intended that, and now I'm revealing it. So I always imagine, I don't really wear a lot of dresses, but I always imagine a dress on a hanger just going, psh, just, you know, hit someone. But one of the other reasons why I decided to use it is that men use pimp, you know, originally, well, and I know it originally meant to be about dressing well, but in an ideal world, if I began calling myself a pimp and everyone who sews and wears nice clothes call themselves pimp, then it might give pimp a secondary meaning, that long lost meaning, which means that men who call themselves pimp will have to clarify what kind of pimp they are. Is it the kind who, no, but really, is it the kind who controls and abuses prostitutes, who are now considered sex workers? And I don't know if the sex worker industry necessarily uses pimps now. I don't know anything about that because I only worked in that area in the 90s. So it's evolved a lot. But I want some men to own what they're saying when they use pimp. And, you know, this is also an unintended consequence. I believe this might be true, but I'm not sure. Hardly any creepers follow me. Like, I don't know if you get creepers trying to follow you.
Mm-hmm. Every day.
Really?
They slip into the DMs.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I don't. I've gotten maybe 15 since I've been on Instagram. Maybe they don't like short hair, but I don't know. My assumption is that my handle is also kind of like an insect repellent.
Yeah.
But I could be wrong.
It's like a creeper deterrent. They don't want to get slapped.
I just don't know. But anyway, that's what it is. You can agree or disagree with it. That's fine. I'm totally fine. That's awesome.
Well, thank you for sharing that story.
And clarifying. So, people were probably going to ask us, and now we know the
answer. Yeah. It helps. Oh,
awesome. So aside from your Instagram, you mentioned your blog. Can you repeat that one, which I know is
okay. Awesome. All right. Yeah. Myeviltit.blogspot.com.
Wonderful. And you've also written some articles on scene work and the socialists, which we mentioned before. So we'll link everything in the show notes. Please go follow Denise. And we didn't even get a chance to talk about this, but you guys have got to go check out Denise's Instagram because for Me Made May, you did jump shots. And your sons took the pictures, right?
Oh, okay. So yeah, quick. I need to talk about that really quickly.
Yeah,
so, okay. So I borrowed my mother-in-law's trampoline. Okay, so I'm not jumping off concrete or grass.
We were like, she's so good at jumping.
No. And I tried explaining that at the beginning, but it gets lost, you know, in everything. So it was my son and two of his friends. They like walking downtown and taking pictures of things. And so I was like, okay, I've got a project for you. Let's do this because I like to try to get the kids involved in different things that are not just social media and cell phones and whatever. So I was like, okay, let's do this. And they were amenable to it. So we hung a white bed sheet outside. It was originally inside, but the boys were like, oh, this doesn't work and all this stuff. And so we had to hang outside in front of our garage. And I was on a trampoline. And it was just my son who was kneeling down, snapping the pictures on his iPhone. And I was jumping. I would do like three jumps. I would just do like three. And he'd be like, I didn't get anything. Just do three more. And I'd just do three more jumps on the trampoline. And that's it. But let me tell you, I mean, I've had a baby. I'm a little older. Let's just say I had to put a wad of toilet paper in my underwear. Yeah. Because insert water drop emoji. So it's not really cool. And some of those pictures I don't necessarily like of myself, but you know, it's their thing. So then my son sent those pictures to his friend who loves to do editing and whatever. And so he edited out the shadows and I just said, just keep the colors as much as natural as possible. You know, don't make them all crazy. But, and so it's their thing.
Did you take them all in one go? Like do all the outfits in one day, or did you take an individual photo?
This was all done on one day. And what I did is there was 14 of them. So I kind of used them like trading cards. I would just look every single day at a photo and be like, okay, well, if that's the photo, let me wear that outfit. And so then I'd post that photo, and then I'd post another picture of me, if you swipe, just wearing the outfit that day. And so that's what I did. I ended up using 13 of the 14 photos.
It's so good. I mean, it's so, so good. Maybe we'll share them on our Instagram feed that week, because those photos are so cool. Really inspiring for people out there who want to like try something different with their Me Made May photos.
All you need is a trampoline.
Yeah, I need to find myself a trampoline for next year. That's such a great idea.
And a couple kids. Get a couple kids and a trampoline.
Very cool. Well, thank you again. I know we've said thank you a million times, and we keep coming back to the conversation because we're having such a good time chatting, but we will let you go. And it's been a real pleasure, Denise.
Hey, thank you, Helen. Thank you, Caroline. This was fabulous. Awesome. You two are wonderful people, and thank you for putting this out into the world.
Oh, you're so welcome. Bye. Bye.
Goodbye.
That's it for today's episode of Love to Sew. You can find me, Caroline, at blackbirdfabrics.com and Helen at helenscloset.ca.
Don't forget to subscribe on Apple Podcasts. And if you are enjoying the show, please leave us a review. It really helps other sewists like yourself to discover us.
We're recording today in sunny Vancouver, Canada, and you can get in touch with us and get links for everything we talked about in this episode at lovetosewpodcast.com.
If you're enjoying the show and you want to help us out, you can support us on Patreon. Contribute $5 or more a month and you'll get access to our bonus episode feed. Go to patreon.com/lovetosew for more info.
Our show is produced by Sam Humphrey.
Thank you, Sam.
And thank you all so much for listening. We will talk to you next week.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Da 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 da.
I was going to say something about that, and now it just slipped away. I can't remember.